Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope.
Welcome back to Anthologies of Hope, and we've got the first of two Conversations Cafe episodes coming your way this week. As always, I'm your host, Rick Osowski, and I'm not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. Before we jump into our live event, recorded from Sip of Hope Coffee Bar in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood, a little promotional work for the next few months. Coming up on Saturday, September 7th, if you are in the greater Chicagoland area, you should definitely join us at the Hope for the Day's inaugural Conversation Summit on the campus of the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Conversation Summit will empower young voices through interactive sessions for learning, dialogue, and activism. Anthologies of Hope will be on site and recording all the main stage events for future releases. There are some amazing guests that you will not want to miss in person, and best of all, the event is free, but you do need to register ahead of time. So head on over to Conversation Summit, that's Conversations with an S, summit.com, for more details and to get your tickets today. Next, we are already deep into planning and production for Season 3 of Anthologies of Hope and our next batch of lived experience interviews. We've already got close to half of our episodes recorded, and just about the other half planned over the next few weeks. If the rest of the interviews are anything like the ones we've done so far, this upcoming season is going to be one you can't stop listening to. We'll also be bringing a couple more channels of content your way, coinciding with the Season 3 release, and it just so happens you'll hear more about the plans for our upcoming blog series and mental health news series later in this very Conversation Cafe. And now, on with the show. As always, Conversations Cafe is a monthly live podcast recording at Sip of Hope Coffee Bar featuring education and open-form dialogue on the intersections of mental health within our communities on a variety of rotating topics. This education programming is brought to you by Hope for the Day, with the support from their partners in prevention, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention of Illinois, and Banyan Treatment Center. This week, our event was simply titled Resiliency, and it featured interviews focusing on options for mental health maintenance to deliver and develop resiliency for ourselves and for the people we care about the most in our lives, our children, our friends, our family, and all the communities we belong to as individuals. Our guests from this week included Sarah Moss, the leader of Hope for the Day's Team Thrive. Team Thrive is Hope for the Day's initiative to celebrate the connection between physical and mental health. If you're interested in hearing more about Team Thrive after hearing Sarah's segment this week, you can check out hftd.org/teamthrive, all one word, for more details. Next up, we have Matthew Hoffman to cover the artistic expression angle of resiliency and how we can use that for ourselves, our loved ones, and our communities. You may be familiar with Matthew's work through the You Are Beautiful campaigns, or more simply, the You Are Beautiful stickers. Matthew details his journey on artistic expression and how it has benefited his everyday life. You can find more about Matthew and his work at itsmematthew.com, the You Are Beautiful campaign at u-r-beautiful, R spelled A-R-E, .com, or visit their flagship store here in Chicago at 3368 North Elston. The next guest from this week's Conversations Cafe is, well, me. That's right. I guested in the live event and talked with our hosts, Carl and Jackie, to discuss how Anthologies of Hope came to be, the wonderful stories that I've been able to hear from our friends and share with all of our listeners. Don't worry. It was definitely super meta for me, too, but you'll definitely want to check out our plans for the future that I cover in my segment. Closing out this week's Conversations Cafe event is Veronica Padilla, the creator and author of Gentle Mentals. Gentle Mentals is an amazing book that aims to shine a playful light on mental illness to soften its stigma. Veronica has an amazing story of resiliency and goes into detail about her life and overcoming living with and working through adversity. The work and movement that Veronica has started with Gentle Mentals is not to be missed. Everyone in attendance when we recorded received a complimentary copy of Gentle Mentals, and I'm super excited to be able to read this with Baby O in the future. For your own copy of Gentle Mentals, the book, as well as plenty of other awesome Gentle Mentals-related merchandise, check out gentlementals.com. Every week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we'll be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you are in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from Hope for the Day and To Write Love in Our Arms. Hope for the Day can be found at hftd.org/find-help, and To Write Love in Our Arms can be found at twloha.com/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, at gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Enough buildup, and you'll hear me talking soon enough again. So without any more wait, this week's episode of Anthologies of Hope and Conversations Cafe, the first from August 2019, Resiliency.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Conversations Cafe, recorded live at Sip of Hope Coffee Bar in Logan Square neighborhood of Chicago, Illinois. We're happy to have you for what is, I believe, our 11th episode recording. So thanks, everyone. Rock and roll, rock and roll. Tonight's episode is produced with the generous support from Banyan Treatment Centers and the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP. And tonight's episode is titled Resiliency. As we're moving into the fall from summer, this is a pretty big major topic for Hope of the Day and our proactive suicide prevention work, because you're gonna hear a little bit about the definition of resiliency, but how we do that with our programming is really talking about, if we've done our work of getting people to recognize it's okay not to be okay, and they reach out for support, and they get into that clinical treatment, therapy sessions and things like that, one of the big tools as you're going through healing or finding management tools is the art of resiliency. But it's not just for individuals who have a diagnosed mental illness or have experienced trauma at some point in their life. Resiliency is something that is relevant for every individual, whether their mental health experiences will ever register or fit a criteria for a diagnosable illness or not. We don't say the word normal because that's just a setting on a washing machine. And we all experience mental challenges in some way or another. So tonight's episode, we have a number of guests who come from different intersections, but we felt strongly can talk about how their work, their efforts, and their passions help contribute to this concept of resiliency in a number of different intersections. So before we go any further, I kind of want to turn it over to our oftentimes co-host, Jackie Carmody, who, I'm going to remember the alphabet soup perfectly, was the LCPCATR, rock and roll, practicing out here in Chicago, to sort of give us a little few technical bullet points about what does resiliency mean past the buzzword.
Definitely. So the basic definition of resiliency is the ability to bounce back after something that is not a normal experience in your everyday life. So with mental health, it could be something as simple as, you know, for a child going to school and having something, you know, a bad day at school, being able to bounce back, go back to school the next day, to, you know, having someone in your personal life die, going through grief, loss, or the end of a relationship or something more severe or traumatic happening. And so the importance of resiliency is just kind of understanding that it is possible and instilling that with children as parents from a young age, to let them know that it is possible to bounce back, but it does require a lot of coping skills and a lot of different tools to get there along the way. It's not just something that can happen out of nowhere. It takes a lot of hard work and understanding what works for you individually in order to be able to do that. So trial and error, you know, if it, you know, you try a bunch of different coping skills, maybe art, music, dance, writing, whatever that may be for you, you find the one that works, try it over and over again and perfect it to be able to bounce back and do your everyday life the best you can. So just kind of understanding this is a conversation that can continue to be had from children as young as they can start talking and listening to, you know, older adults and throughout, you know, every life experience. I think it can be applicable.
Thank you, Jackie. And as someone who's a suicide survivor with lived experience, one of the things I think of with resiliency is that it's, and you brought this up perfectly, Jackie, is tools. So a lot of our guests are going to be talking about things in which they represent or have produced or have found themselves tools that enhance or contribute to their sense of resiliency. Because one of the big messages we want people to understand is a lot of Hope of the Day's messaging, when we talk about it's okay not to be okay, isn't just about that initial starting the conversation. As you're going on, for some experiences you're going to have, there might be the illusion that there's going to be one magic wand to address your mental health, that it's one therapy session or one pill or this one powerful speech you heard from someone, and then all of a sudden it's all a bed of roses. But the reality is that, and I'll speak from the personal ground on this point, that for my past experiences that brought me to sort of mental health crisis and imminent risk of harm, my better isn't that I don't have challenging days or days in which bring me very low. But the difference between me before sort of working through therapy and finding tools and strength and after is that when the bad days come, I understand that there's certain things I need to reach out for in real time as opposed to trying to bottle it up and sort of keep it silent. And when we talk about resiliency, whether it's something that parents are trying to install in youth or it's us as young adults, adults at any point in age, really, these are tools that we're always constantly working on, and they're the tools that help us give an opportunity to face a sort of a dark place if we have it and understand that we can press on the next day. They're the things that become our supports. This should never, when we talk about mental health, it should never be thought of that you get to a sense of perfection and you're this perfect, unbroken, no cracked stone. I often would describe my own experiences as that I had a lot of healing, but there's some places that there's still scars. And I think a lot of people, whether you're coming from a clinical background where you might have something that's with you the rest of your life, or you're coming from something, a traumatic experience or a combination thereof, a big thing we got to get out of our mental health discussions is this idea that you're going to achieve the sense of perfection. And why we love the concept of resiliency is recognizing that you're going to crack. You're going to have fissures in your experience. You're going to have very weak points, so-called breaking points. That's why we try to spend a lot of time at Hope for the Day avoiding languaging that says things like don't give up. And every once in a while, we might have an Instagram post slip through, but the fact is we don't want to use this language as if it's some masculinity-oriented idea that maintaining your mental health and balance is a sense of exclusively willpower and muscle strength. That's not how mental health works. You're going to be laid low sometimes by the things you experience. And it's important to understand that that's not part of the problem. It doesn't make you weak or less because maybe you are in therapy or maybe you're considering therapy, but you find yourself just hard to function or step out of the door one day. That doesn't make you a lesser person. Mental health is so intensive that that's going to happen. And so why we like the idea of resiliency is it's a recognition and a constant affirmation that this is not supposed to be you get to a point where you're this perfect monolith and you've got all the answers. There's going to be times where you need to lean back onto your supports. So with that, our first guest today is going to be talking to us from the perspective of a very critical tool for their own resiliency. Hope for the Day has a number of opportunities for individuals to get involved and become an agent of impact in their community on mental health. And if you join the Hope for the Day Agents of Impact program, you can advance all the way to the level of a surrogate, and there's different ways to press the conversation. One of those is a project we have called Team Thrive, which was inspired by a friend of the Hope for the Day family, Dan Haas, who passed away doing something that he loved. He was an endurance athlete who found balance for his experiences with bipolar disorder through endurance sports and always being active. And he unfortunately passed away from a snake bite out hiking in the trails of Colorado. But one of Dan's dear friends who came to the Hope for the Day family through that connection wanted to carry the torch on and carry Team Thrive forward. And Team Thrive is really about the intersection of physical activity and mental health. And so we are super, super stoked to have the torchbearer for Team Thrive, Sarah Moss, join us. So Sarah Moss, come on up.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Hi, Sarah. It's a pleasure to see you.
Hello, thank you.
So we wanted to just really quickly talk. Give us a quick elevator on your background. We'll just start right there.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and background as far as like my physical career are you talking about?
Yeah, a little bit.
So I guess, well, first of all, I grew up the overweight kid. So I was never the big active kid growing up. I was actually considered the fat sister growing up. And when I graduated college, I just had an aha moment and it was time to get in shape. And I did. I had no more excuses after I graduated college. One of my college, very good friend of mine from college, her and I decided to start working out together. And then I moved here to Chicago And Chicago had a really good running community. They still have a great running community. But back then, they had a lot of meetup at bars where you would literally go run 3 to 6 miles and come back and socialize and have beer and wings and whatnot. So I got really involved with that and it just started evolving. And I had friends convince me to do my first race was the Shamrock Shuffle. And then I had a friend convince me to do the marathon. And then I think maybe I convinced him to do that. Then he convinced me to do an Ironman. And here about, I think 10, 12 years later, I have probably 20 plus marathon under my belt. 4 Ironmans and some half Ironmans. And I don't know, too many races to count. And one coming up, which is very exciting. We'll talk about that later.
So one of the things that's a part of Team Thrive's creation is the amount of people who have reached out to us and talked about how they found running or working out or Zumba or meditation or yoga. It's not just, they kind of almost verbalized it as they felt it was a part of keeping them balanced in mental health. That was how Danny talked about it early on. Where does that mental health intersect for you with that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt. You know, I will still admit to this day that I definitely have an eating disorder of some sort, addiction to food. I may or may not have replaced that with exercise instead, because I always joke if I ever get injured, I don't know what I'm going to do, because exercise is my outlet. That is what my go-to. It's helped me through a lot. I was actually thinking about this the other day, that running has helped me through a lot of processes. You were talking about mental health is in so many different levels, but my mother passed away. It'll be about 4.5 years ago. And during that time, I was also dealing with a significant other who was going through a lot of his mental health issues and dealing with my mother passing away. That was a long process. Being a caretaker is never easy. But looking back, and I had this moment just a couple weeks ago that I was in the best shape of my life during that point. That's when I had my marathon personal record and everything else. And that's how I coped, was my runs. I mean, I remember vividly, I can tell you where my mom's hospice house was located. She was there for 6 months, and I know that neighborhood like I know my neighborhood now. It's kind of interesting in that aspect of, but that was my self-care during that part.
Definitely. So I have a question. Working with a lot of clients, they kind of go through this trial and error period, and they want to give up because nothing feels like it's working. So I guess, could you tell us a little bit about your trial and error and how, you know, you had to try different things and what worked, what didn't work, and how you figured out that running was yours?
You know, I want to say probably the community. You know, the running community is so welcoming no matter who you are, what you are, no matter how fast you are, how slow you are, how what your ability is, what you look like, what your religion is, what, I mean, the running community is so open. You know, so is the triathlon world to a certain extent. And, you know, don't take me wrong on this one. But with running, you can't judge. I mean, everybody has the same $100 pairs of shoes, you know, or, you know, it doesn't matter. But in other sports and other things, they can judge you on your bike and different things like that. But the running community, I felt like was just, it's a very welcome community. And I think that's what really got me involved with running and kept me going. But there's a lot of great people out there, and it's been good.
Definitely. Yeah. So I guess one other quick question is, the feedback from other people in your life. You know, you said growing up, you were considered the fat sister. That kind of, I guess, how many sisters you have? Knowing I have 3 sisters, I know that can be a lot of feedback going at once.
Sure.
So I guess when you decided to make that lifestyle change and do something that was working for you, did you get any feedback from people who hadn't found something that was working for them through all the family stress?
Sure. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I have 2 older brothers, so they do. You know, I go down to Indy. I'm somewhat originally from Indianapolis, Indiana, and there's the Indy Mini every year. And I started doing that race, and then all of a sudden, my family members started doing it. Even my cousin, who has never ran a mile in her life, went and bought shoes from Sam's Club and had the worst blisters ever. She's probably going to love me for this, but she had the worst blisters ever. But she went out and did the half marathon with us. And it was like, okay, well, this is good. And everybody feels so great after they do it and after they accomplish something.
That's such a good point. And, you know, one of the things with this idea around like the physical activities with Team Thrive, you know, we're still somewhat in the early, you know, it's officially out there and it's launched and everything. But you're doing these run meetups that are starting to wind up at Sip of Hope, the last Wednesday of every month. And talking about the community sense, before you found it, did you feel like you had a strong connection to other spaces, or was when you got to the running community, was that kind of like sort of discovering a sense of belonging?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm sure you have your, you know, friends and whatnot in college, but they were your college friends that you would go out to bars with and drink and get silly. So yes and no, but I think just the running community is a community that I've never felt like that before. And I mean, some of those people are still to this day my best friends that I will have forever. You know, I've been a pace leader for Kara for the Chicago Marathon. Still some of those people that I pace are still some of my best friends. There's just a lot of good people. It's just the community of belonging. I can go a little bit more. Something that I definitely wanted to bring up is the more I talk about this, and as we celebrate the connection between physical health and mental health, last year I was in D.C. at a running convention getting my running coach certification. And you go around the room and everybody asks, what are you here for? What are you planning on doing with and whatnot? Mine was a couple of different reasons, more personal, but then also, you know, with the help with everything with Team Thrive. But I talked to them about Team Thrive and how we're starting this initiative and getting the word out, healthy body, healthy mind, taking care of yourself. You have a healthy mind. And it was amazing how many people came up to me afterwards and thanked me for starting this initiative, and the stories about someone's husband who has hit rock bottom due to mental illness, and all of this, you know, he started running and his personality and everything has changed tremendously. And just the more that we talk about getting out and doing stuff, the more stories you hear. And it doesn't have to be crazy marathons. It doesn't have to be crazy Ironmans. It doesn't have to be any of that. I encourage people to go out for a walk around the block at lunchtime, get outside, do something. If it's yoga, if it's dance, find what you love to do, because otherwise you won't stick with it. So you don't have to do running. Just make that clear.
Totally. Well, I think, too, we don't realize how much energy is in our bodies, and we're kind of like a jar where everything sinks to the bottom if we don't move, and then, like, just move. Shake it up.
Absolutely.
It works.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
And I like that you bring that up, because some of the queries that we've started getting as we've started to push out Team Thrive have come from a different intersection where unfortunately, and I'm just going to pivot off a lived experience here, for especially individuals who have experienced diagnosable illnesses, traumas, things like that, an adverse impact of mental health challenges is a physical impact too, whether it's anything from inactivity, which has its own connection, all the way into things like coping mechanisms like overeating and things like that. So, I just sort of wanted to, you had sort of briefly touched on like eating disorders and things like that. And I was just sort of, I mean, this might actually be a Jackie question. You know, when people talk about like getting active and physical, we can say, yeah, it's, you know, the dopamine dump and serotonin's out there and everything like that. But is it people's just their imaginations when they start getting more active and physical, or is there something? And not just the chemical release thing, mm-hmm. but like.
Well, I think with anything, when you are looking for change and you can physically see it, it feels more rewarding and more reinforcing. So, I mean, I think when you are putting the work into something and it's your own body and you're able to say like, wow, these are muscles I built, or this, you know, I'm noticing myself feeling stronger and feeling more energized. I think that can be reinforcing. So I guess in terms of it being related to an eating disorder, I guess what was the...
Substantive value, right?
Right. So I think it just has more of a immediate reinforcer as like a human to see that as part of something that you're with every day, 24/7. So that it is a strong coping skill to have.
Yeah. And to chime in a little bit on that, there's a book out there, and I can't remember who the author is, so I apologize. But I believe it's called Running is My Therapy, and there is a lot of research back there about how scientifically your mind changes and whatnot, and it does help. And I've also, in like Runner's World and a lot of magazines, a lot of articles recently have come out talking about how exercise does improve your mental state. But also there's a, and I wish I remember the article, but it was in Runner's World, and it talked about there's some countries out in Europe who will actually prescribe an exercise regimen before they prescribe an antidepressant of some sort, given the severity of the patient, obviously. But that is something that they would do before they get prescribe an antidepressant for 3 months and then go from there.
Totally. And even from the clinical perspective, like working with clients, I'll just be like, well, why don't you try this before, you know, doing anything else or just trying something different, I think.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's a good point because, you know, we're always certain to sort of highlight, like, you know, if someone's going through something, for instance, a clinical depression, you might get a lot of sort of pseudoscience, be like, well, just go for a run and do some yoga and have a bath bomb. And that's not really what the point is, especially with a thing like Team Thrive. And what we're going for is not, oh, go on and do a marathon. And I'm glad you brought that up because the real thing we're after is this idea of just embracing. So whether it is running or things like that, for some people it might be woodworking. That's a physical activity.
Totally, yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
So and I love where we're going now. Sort of what are your sort of top goals with Team Thrive, you know, sort of moving forward?
Sure. You know, it's opening the ideas and the dialogue for those that are in the athletic community to know that it's okay not to be okay, kind of like the hope for the day, and just to bring that community out to support each other and encourage each other and, you know, maybe help a new person that's getting into running to help them get started. There's so many different directions that we could turn this, but I think it's just bringing a community to get together to let us know that it's okay not to be okay, and you're going to have good days and you're going to have bad days.
I love that too, because driving home on this whole, the big aspirations here is a really important other factor aside from the direct qualitative and quantitative impact of physical activity and stuff like that. In athletic or physically active communities, if stigma is everywhere, stigma does take a certain shape in physical activity areas too. So like there's, whether it's a sort of a masculinity thing or just a sort of, I am runner or I am lifter or I'm a fighter or I'm a wrestler or I'm a BMX biker, you still get that sense of like, I've got it all together. So I think that's a really cool thing with you sort of sharing your truth out there.
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually a lot of professional athletes that are starting to come out about their mental health struggles that I would love to chime in. We need to figure out how to do that and have them be our spokesperson, which would be awesome.
Totally. Well, what I liked what you said about community, like there's just, it feels less competitive when you say it as like a term of community. And I think there's a lot of anxiety that builds for many people when competition is involved. And so looking at it as a community-based thing, I think really changes the whole look of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, something with that on our, as Carl stated earlier, we have a run out of Sip of Hope the last Wednesday of every month right now. And we do have everybody. This last month we had walkers, we had people that are 6 minute miles, and we had a little bit of everything. So it is just, you know, I guess having accountability as well. So getting someone out there and be like, all right, I'm going to meet you here the last Wednesday of every month at 6:30. Let's do this. Whether you're a runner or you're a walker or whatever the case may be, come and join us.
That's perfect. And I might join you on a scooter. So I'm not a running level.
You better. I'm holding. We just heard that. I'm holding you to that, Carl.
So the last part about that and why we were so excited to make sure this was a run meetup out of Hope and want to continue with Team Thrive was something that I'm blatantly stealing from the wonderful folks we heard from the Wonder Bus, where Team Thrive is another opportunity to make connections. And we had guests, the Wonder Bus, a couple of, like 2 months ago on, and they said something to us, and they were quoting somebody else, and they're saying that connections are the currency of wellness. So it's just such a pleasure to see you carry on this torch and continue to endeavor and build this program with Hope for the Day. Do you have any races coming up or anything like that?
I do. So in 4 weeks, I will actually be preparing for my 5th Ironman. So let me back up for a minute. I think Dan kind of started this for me, and I do have to give my shout out to Dan. I miss that little whatever. But he's always pushed me to do something different and always encouraged myself to keep pushing myself. So every year I've set a scare the crap out of me goal. I usually use another word, but and he started it when I went out a couple years ago, right before he passed away. And thank God I did. But did a bike ride with him out in Steamboat, Colorado. And thank God I did because it was the summer before he passed away. And I almost backed out because my father was in the process with a terminal cancer. So I didn't put the training in like I should have. Living here in Chicago, we have no hills. And Steamboat, Colorado, I was greeted by a 7-mile mountain. So ever since then, I've had to scare the crap out of my goal. So my goal this year is to do my first full Ironman internationally. So I'm going to be going to South Korea here next month to do a full Ironman. I know nothing about, I know a little bit about South Korea, but I know it's not close. And I know it's a 14-hour plane ride. I don't know the language. And it's not in Seoul where, you know, it's probably, you know, a little bit more English. It's about 4 hours south of Seoul. So this will be an interesting experience, to say the least. So,
should we do a follow-up podcast on that one?
Hey, yeah. As long as I come back alive, I will.
Well, you'll be there in the social media sphere with us. So.
Yes.
And I can't thank you enough. And, you know, we also, if anyone looks at the Sip of Hope founder's wall, and was, you know, every name on there has a story, and you've just basically learned a lot about, like, why Dan Haas's name is on that wall with us. So as a... Let's do a plug for the run meetup one more time.
Yep. So last Wednesday of every month, we'll be here at Sip of Hope. We meet here around 6:15 and run around 6:30. Distances are 3 to 5 miles, but honestly, you can come and run whatever you want. But it's just a place to meet up and keep you accountable. So hopefully we'll do more than once a month, but this is a good start.
Thank you so much. And if you'd like to learn more about Team Thrive, check out Hope of the Day, hftd.org. Look at the Get Involved section and become an agent of impact, and you can join the Team Thrive initiative. So thank you so much, Sarah Moss.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right, so with that, talking about resiliency, and you have this sort of sense of you're out running or you're out lifting or you're jumping jacks or jumping rope or biking or what have you, taking part in sort of physical activity in that intersection is a great way of building resiliency. For a lot of people, though, they may have that part of their lives, they may not. But as we're going on in our day-to-day experiences, another facet for resiliency is sometimes working towards a positive mindset. And we don't mean like pink clouds and put a mask on and always think positive, but sort of sometimes you need reinforcement and things to remind you, especially when you're in a murky place. And for some people, negative mindsets can be require a total clinical level of engagement, but sometimes for a lot of folks, sometimes you need a certain, just a nudge, on a day-to-day nudge. And we know, it goes without a doubt, especially at Hope for the Day, because our roots are in self-expression, is that art is such a powerful way to make connections with people. And Sip of Hope, if you ever have a chance to come to the shop, right when you walk in, one of the two things that's probably going to hit you right in the face is, well, probably three things. You're going to see, you know, that we're in this together. You are going to see a beautiful mural by Lauren Asta. And it might be a little bit subtle, but you're also going to see Hope for the Day's banner cry, "It's Okay Not to Be Okay," in very bold, well-etched out lettering along one of our brick walls. And those were created by someone who, and you're going to laugh at this, someone whose work, a lot of you who are listening, a lot of you who are live, you've probably seen, but you may not necessarily know who's responsible for that. And a lot of you probably already do know, judging by a lot of the success and notoriety our next guest has. But if you've ever seen a small little sticker or very big printed out on a school or just you're driving somewhere around the street and you see something that might say something like, "You are beautiful," that was created by a very intelligent, talented gentleman named Matthew Hoffman. And so our next guest is Matthew Hoffman. So we've done a lot of cool things with you, Matthew. Thank you for joining us. But I kind of want to just start right from scratch and just give us a little bit of background and how you ended up in the creative spaces you're in now.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I love that you said earlier woodworking was a sport because it is. It's full contact. And we just came from doing 6-foot-tall letters. I came straight here like at 4200 diversity. We just put up a brand new piece. So it's really exciting. But yeah, so I mean, you know, basically, you know, my whole sort of life is that I was, you know, a tinker at a young age. Didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And then in high school, took a course in graphic arts that kind of like changed my life, where it kind of showed me what you can do with words, with phrases, how you can sort of like take your thoughts and share them with other people. And so when I moved to Chicago in 2002, it was kind of the heart of, you know, the golden age of street art, I think. And it was my first time in an urban environment, and it was very, very exciting. You know, I lived in all small towns and rural areas. And it was super exciting to explore the city, but it was also a little overwhelming. And there's a lot of noise and a lot of audible noise, visual noise. And then you kind of have like a lot of billboards sort of saying, like, don't feel good about yourself until you buy our product, and then feel good about yourself. And so I just wanted to make a simple, comforting message that said there's nothing you need to do, no one you need to be, just be yourself, and that's enough. And so it started with 100 stickers, and I kind of passed those out or, you know, slapped them up, and then started with really small just installations that I, the first one was fridge magnets that I glued to the underside of a bridge. And I was like terrified to do it. It was so silly. And, you know, it, and then the end result was like pretty embarrassing. But it's still there. It's 15 years riding strong. I won't tell you where it is, so you don't go take it. and that's just kind of the, you know, the journey, the process that, you know, we started printing more stickers, you know, we started making larger installations, and we're up to 5.5 million stickers in 100 different languages all around the world.
Wow. So I guess I have a question. I'm an art therapist, and I work with a lot of teens and young kids who love creating, love making art, and that's their form of self-expression. And they don't want to talk sometimes. They just want to make art. So I guess how could you, like, what did you do to kind of explain to people that this was what was working for you when you were discovering it through graphic design or through woodworking? How did you find that to be your therapy?
Well, yeah, I mean, I find so much therapy in working. So if I'm really, a lot of times when I'm sort of like going through like a rough patch or I'm really stressed out or whatever, the thing I do is I just throw myself into the work. And there's something about like creating and making, and it, for me, it being physical, that I get to sort of like see that tangible result. And so for me, it's like the whole process and then, you know, the end result.
Totally. And I love that you said process, because I feel like that's so important. When making art, people are so focused on the end result. Like, what is it going to look like? Can I draw? Do I know how to draw? And it's like, no, it's just the process. Just enjoy like being mindful and like putting something on paper or like making a mark. So I think that's really important.
And I'm glad you talk about that, because especially in, there's other phrasings and workings, but you know, when we're talking about You Are Beautiful, what you touched on early on with buy this product, and it sort of sounds like consumerism. One of the big things we're always trying to work towards is the fact that one way stigma works is that it compels us to have to match ourselves up externally. It sort of creates this monolith where we have to evaluate ourselves. So even your mental health, you say, well, whatever I'm going through isn't as bad as so-and-so, or it's in my mind, or things like that. So I'd really love to know, you put, you know, you started doing these, you know, actions basically. Did you kind of know where it was going, or did you figure like, I'll try this? How did you know that this was sort of like connecting, or like that you should keep going?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've never had any sort of plan at all. but I'm a big believer in just like getting out those raw ideas and then refining in the real world. So I've put out I'm always just like, put it out there. Then like kind of gauge reaction, see how I feel about it. And then kind of like follow that path, whatever that path is. And so early on, I just made a single HTML webpage that said, if you want 5 free stickers, I got you-are-beautiful.com. Just said, if you want 5 free stickers, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to this address. And it was my studio's address. And like one day, just a letter came in. And I was like, oh, that's crazy. And then like more and more mail came in. And then a lot of mail started pouring in. And what was interesting is that over that time, the letters went from just like, so essentially like it's a empty envelope inside another envelope that you send back. Well, in there were like letters and cards and just how they came across one of these stickers and what it did for them in that moment. And then how they wanted to sort of get those stickers and give those moments to other people. And so that's really how that project has spread, completely by the community.
That's amazing. Yeah. Do I'm going to put you on the spot. Do any of those letters or any of the stories stick out? Maybe was there any particular one where you're like, whoa, this has gone to a whole different level than I thought?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, early on when I was still getting mail at the studio, we got a P.O. box just to kind of like, and then I would get sort of monthly phone calls that like the box was too full and I was going to get charged for a larger box. And it was always this fight with the post office for some reason. I don't know, but they never sent anything back.
They needed a sticker, I think.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But yeah, early on there was a letter and they sent a photograph and where they had put one on a bridge railing. And it was right above a plaque where someone had committed suicide. And they said that they hoped that by putting that sticker there, that someone who would maybe be at that point would come to it and rethink those actions. And to me, that really hit me pretty deeply because, I mean, in the end, it's just some letters typed out and made into stickers. And but that it can do so much. It was kind of like a lot for me to sort of like take on.
That's beautiful. And I think what's important to understand there, especially your drive home on that point, is that sometimes we get it lost in our heads that things have to be big, complicated speeches or sort of big, fancy, done-up things. But I think, and again, it goes right back to sort of where your inspirations were in the beginning, the simplicity of it. You know, it's you are beautiful, and it's not saying you are beautiful and follow me on my, you know, Insta page or something like that. It's not asking or trying to take anything from someone. And society, it doesn't matter, America or anywhere else. I think we are consistently bombarded in a way that, you know, the world's trying to take something from you, whether it's cash or your energy or something. So you started there, you went from the studio, and now that you've sort of continued to grow and elevate, what sort of drives, you know, these newer projects where you started to scale up and go bigger and bigger? What sort of like the inspiration behind that? Or I mean, like what sort of like makes you want to keep pressing that way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the biggest thing for me is to make positive messages and put them out in the public. That's sort of like my end all be all. That's my happy place. And that's what really drives me. And so whatever sort of like dictates doing that, whether, I'll get asked a lot, like sort of, you know, what's your big plan or what's your big vision? I don't really have one. I'm just going to keep pressing, keep doing this thing and keep putting these positive messages out there to hopefully help myself and other people. And to me, that's amazing. And if that's sort of like keeping on scaling and making grand, amazing things and, you know, 1,000-foot letters in the desert, like that's awesome. And if I'm like 80 years old and just still putting a couple stickers and some self-addressed stamped envelopes, that's cool too.
Amazing. So let me ask you, so there's that part of it, but I'd really like to also go back in when we're talking about this idea of resiliency. I want to focus in on the actual craft process. So the stickers was a process, and when you're talking about the woodcutting, you just did an exhibition with Hope for the Day. Talk a little bit about that, but also the fact that like people could come in and actually look at the studio. You know, you had some of those tours, and so I'd really like to just learn about, you know, because you had support and folks of that. Just sort of, what does that mean to you just to be able to do the woodworking, do that creative spirit? And, like, I think it's important for people to hear sort of, you know, mental health, like I said before, isn't just yoga and bath bombs and Enya. Much respect to Enya, yoga bombs and, wait, yoga and bath bombs. But, right. You know. So,
I think, too, like, having, like, a space, too, that is your space to do it in, I think is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Tons of loud power tools and stuff, but 100% of the time on Spotify, deep focus plays. It drives everyone insane, but I really like it. But yeah, you're right. There's absolutely, it's so important to have a space to work in, a space that you kind of go and this is that space where I'm doing this. And, whether that's like a nook in like your living room or, you know, an extra bedroom, or, I mean, we worked out of my 2-car garage for the last 5 years until things grew out so much that we were just exploding out of the seams and, the city was like, no.
So especially, you know, we have a diverse audience, but I think that's for creative endeavors that don't necessarily fit into maybe like a popularly commercialized thing, that it's not just oil painting or photography. Much respect to oil painting and photography. What sort of, if somebody's like, oh, that's great, but I don't know how to do woodworking or whatever, I'm not asking you to like give tips on that, but sort of going back to what Jackie said, how did graphic arts is one thing, but how did you even go into like the hand, you know, hands-on work?
Oh, okay. Well, so that kind of goes like further back than that, where I sort of said like I was a tinker, like we would go to, you know, estate sales and auctions and we would get like old TVs and those tube radios, and I would just like sit in the basement, like taking them apart, and like, you know, you get shocked a couple times and you learn what, you know, not to do that. And you know, you just kind of just mess around and play with things. And then in middle school, they had all the trade classes still. So metalsmithing and wood shopping. And I just was drawn to wood shop, and it's something about the, you know, wood being natural and what you can do with it. There's just something really, really wonderful about it. And so then basically, kind of like that sort of like graphic design and woodworking kind of came together into where it is now.
Perfect. And I think just sort of rounding out that part, it may not counterintuitive, but again, people may not think of hobby crafting as being an important part of the mental health structure. And so, I mean, this is probably, I pivot a little bit over to Jackie on this, to just sort of, it's not therapy, it's not the bath, I keep going back to the bath bombs, but what is hobbying? I want to hear from you, Matt, but just...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think focusing on the word process, like you said, and so within the art therapy field, we use that word pretty heavily, and it's kind of like a, I don't know, it kind of explains, like, starting with nothing and choosing different materials and the act of being mindful throughout that choosing process and applying. And I think it's more than just the outcome of what it is. It's choosing to start with nothing and then working your way and trial and erroring it. And that whole process of seeing change can really result in something therapeutic, because you're making something, you're seeing that change happen, you're feeling frustrated, lots of different emotions are coming up throughout, and that in itself can be really therapeutic. And so I think what you were saying has a lot of elements that art therapy really preaches.
And so for you, Matthew, if you have a frustrating day, would you, you know, we talk about the soda bottle at Hope for the Day a lot, and that your mind can build up with pressure, and pressure can come from things you're diagnosed with, things you experience externally, but a big key is finding valves, ways to let out that pressure healthily before it overwhelms. Would you sort of say that the whole process is part of a valve? Is it, if you have a frustrating day, do you go to, you're going to go into the wood shop? Is that kind of like a good outlet for you, or is it hard to like focus on that stuff when you're?
No, it's great. I mean, I think like now the scale that we're making things at, you know, I obviously have help, and then also we have a lot of machinery that sort of like is all computer operated. And so it's sort of like churning these things out, where you're not making as much as by hand. You're still assembling things and that sort of thing. So yeah, if I've had a rough day, I'll go and just like grab a jigsaw, you know, and just, you know, go, you know, either just kind of attack a current project that's needing to get worked on. And so that helps me, because it furthers that along, or just try to do something like creative and just completely off the cuff and see where it goes.
I guess for people who don't have access to those types of materials, where they don't really feel comfortable walking to a Michael's and like getting crafty, but they feel like a stronger urge to make something or, you know, deal with a tool, where would you encourage them to get started or kind of dabble in like what could be a coping skill for them?
Well, you know, when I started out, I just couldn't afford anything. So I was always rummaging like through alleys and just trying to get anything that I could. Yeah. The very first large cursive You Are Beautiful piece, similar to this piece, it was made from pieces of crates. Like I found this giant crate, took it all apart, and then used the wood for that. So, I mean, I think that, you know, there's something great to, you know, going to just odd places. Like dollar stores are awesome. Like one of my favorite places. And now it's like a little pastime that my son and I go to now, you know. But he's moved up to the 5 and below, which is a little more pricey.
Thank you for that. So before we wrap up here, I started off by sort of mentioning the fact that, and you know, that story about putting the sticker on the bridge kind of drives home. You started out sort of chasing this in a sense of a passion, right? And it's kind of taken on a life of its own in a lot of ways. And that really connects with a lot of, you know, Hope for the Day's sort of spirit and philosophy. There's a lot of words that we use that we feel are important, and It's Okay Not to Be Okay is something that was often said on stage, things like that, but we found that it started to stick with people. So when we think like You Are Beautiful, and as you continue to endeavor and enhance your creative outlets, we really like to know sort of, you talk about scaling up and everything, but in your heart of hearts, what's the thing you're most proud about with the work that you've done so far, and, you know, just, and what are you anticipating doing sort of in the next couple of months? Yeah. You know, like, what's next, right? Because I know you said you don't plan anything, right? So
yeah. I mean, I think the thing that, like, I'm just, like, I don't feel like I'm really able to really take it in, because when you're in it, you're not able to see the forest for the trees. But the community that has come around this message, and the fact that, you know, constantly, every single day, we're sending out packages all around the world. It's, you know, it's not just like here and there or in Chicago. It's you know, you're able to send things to people, you know, in other countries and other languages. And it's, you know, that's incredible that, like, either outside in the public art or in people's homes, that you're being a part of their day, you're being a part of their life, and that they're excited to sort of, like, share what you're talking about. And so that's just, it's pretty overwhelming, and that's probably, like, the thing I'm most proud of, yeah.
That's great. So, I'm sorry.
No, I just was agreeing.
Before we clip out, got to drop where people can check you out. Where can people find out about Matthew Hoffman?
Yeah. So I do personal installations under heyitsmatthew.com, and then You Are Beautiful with dashes in between. And then we have our flagship store at 3368 North Elston here in Chicago.
Fantastic. Matthew, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure.
Awesome. Thank
you. So just as where we have this theme with Team Thrive and the physical intersection, and the way You Are Beautiful works as a way of raising the visibility of messaging and connecting with people, and there's this background story also for Matthew's own passions involved. Cycling around resiliency, you know, supporting it, contributing to it, helping other people sort of find tools for positive affirmation. Another way of doing this is also sharing stories, and Sarah and Matthew shared a lot of their personal background stories. And when people share stories, I mean, this is not some sort of newfangled or revolutionary statement, but sharing stories also gives us a chance to connect, not feel alone. And that can help build resiliency, especially when you're in a really low place. Hearing about how others both experience something similar, or you connect with someone similar, and then hearing maybe how other people try to sort of climb out, or what helped others, can spark inspiration, give people hope. So our next guest is actually the co-producer of Conversations Cafe. And the way we connected is he had been coming to Hope for the Day education work and just sort of around the Hope for the Day community. And we found out that he'd been running a podcast called Anthologies of Hope. And when we were starting to discuss this idea of getting into the podcast world, originally we were just going to say, well, let's do Anthologies of Hope here in the shop. And then this morphed into he volunteered to say, well, let's just make this an ongoing thing. And as this whole Conversations Cafe thing takes on a life of its own, we've been very delighted to welcome into the Hope Squad family a gentleman named Rick, who I want you to meet right now. So everyone say hi to Rick.
Hello, Rick. Oh, wow. See, he does this too.
The consummate producer. So, and I'll fully, because, you know, we want to make sure we're always honest and open. I'm saying Rick because I just recognized that I was going to waffle on your last name. So please, for the record, state your...
Rick Osowski. So there's usually an extra S or a Z put in there. But yeah, so just Rick Osowski.
Yeah, I'm sorry, because I was going to go with, like,
Oscar. I've had it for 36 years. It's never gotten right most of the time on the first try, so I take no offense.
But thank you so much, Rick. Give us a little bit. Give us the elevator, man. Where are you from?
So I came into Chicago about three years ago with my now wife, who is from the suburbs. But I have a long history of just having conversations with friends and always kind of talking. And then we would always end up having the same conversations with all of our other friends, but they were just heavy conversations of people dealing with stuff that we didn't really know how to get to the bottom of stuff, or that we had problems that, again, just talking about things would help resolve them. And so it ended up being, like Carl alluded to, the Wide Wonder Bus, with just the connection of people being the foundation of kind of what we're looking for. So I, because of that, like, I've always loved podcasts, and I had just a deep connection with all the long form, nonfiction conversational podcasts. So, going back in the day, and like, I've been a huge Kevin Smith fan. So he had started a huge, kind of podcast, catalog. And he's someone that can kind of talk for hours. And one of the things that he had said, or he said multiple times, was, a story growing up that he wanted to be a filmmaker. He was talking to his sister, and his sister said, "Okay, well, what's stopping you?" And he's like, "Well, I'm not a filmmaker. I can't make films." And so his sister was like, "Just do the thing. Just make a movie and you're a filmmaker." And so for me, that's kind of just been my thing from day one. When I lived in North Carolina, I always had, or growing up, I always had a thing for woodworking. To me, it just seemed like math and science applied to physical materials, and it wasn't that hard. Once I started, I learned it was a little bit more than that. There's definitely an art to it, as the adage, measure twice, cut once, comes into play a lot. But after that, it was like, well, what if I could tell the conversations that we're having with friends just on a podcast? And so it was Google's your friend, just figure out how to do some of the stuff. And since then, I've had a lot of people that have been very forward about coming and saying, "This is what happened to me. It's helped me when I've talked to people about it. I would want to help somebody else when I can help them hear it." So since then, it's kind of been the most of the motto that I'm half blocking here, but the biggest, you know, blocker to suicide prevention is silence. And then a lot of the stigma associated with silence. So it just ends up being a case of having a platform to be able to talk about whatever you want and whatever is, you know, building on you, weighing on you, what you've survived, what you're currently surviving, what you're currently fighting. And then it's gotten a lot of good reception. So I'm very happy for it.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to touch on is just what you were saying is people had they were empowered to kind of tell their story. I think that's a really important thing to take away, is that we hear someone else's narrative, and it inspires us to be like, okay, well, I'm going through something. Maybe I don't have to just feel it. I can also create a narrative out of it, and then it just becomes something outside of yourself, and it kind of has a container to live in instead of just kind of living within your body.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think, because as I'm sitting here, this is a little bit meta too, right? Where
I was standing back there half an hour thinking of how meta it was. So yeah, okay, it definitely is.
Because it's going in a loop. But one of the things that I've really drawn from listening to Anthologies of Hope stories is, aside from like the, now that it's an industry, podcast is an industry, one of the coolest things about Anthologies of Hope is the fact that there's no rhyme or reason to the setup. And that was inspiration for Conversations Cafe, that we didn't want to set like, we didn't want to just put everything into a box. Like the topics we're going to talk about, we sort of produce and generate as it goes on. So for Anthologies of Hope, did you kind of, it was plug in and just start talking, but where did the mental health part really come into it? You know what I mean?
So the genesis of it came from attending a workshop from the founder of To Write Love in Our Arms. Jamie Twerkowski hosted a workshop called Heart Camp. My wife attended the first one. I attended the third one in LA, and it kind of, with the connections we made with all the people there that were looking for something about just authenticity, writing, starting a movement, and just mental health advocates and supporters, it was a case of seeing all the conversations that we were having and then just sitting in the room and just being like, these stories and this support and this passion shouldn't just be contained in the room. It should be something that is easily accessible and everybody can hear, because it just ends up being a force multiplier. Like, as soon as you hear somebody's story, then you're like, oh, like, that ends up being a case that I can now do more, or like, this doesn't feel as much. And so for the general listening audience,
and the live audience here, I have a 3-month-old at home. And so going through a, as Chris looks and giggles, I have a 3-month-old at home. And so that's our first baby. And so being a new father is definitely a new experience there. So just dealing a lot and just kind of figuring out and trying to catch up both with work, running a podcast, baby, being a husband, being a friend, all of that. There's, you know, a lot going on at the same time and how to balance it all. So I was interviewing Joel yesterday, the new, let me get this right, public policy director for Hope for the Day. I was interviewing him at the Hope for the Day offices. He has very many things going on at the same time, similarly. And so I asked him, like, how do you feel like it's enough? And his response was simply like, generally you don't. Like, it's like, that's what makes it a calling as opposed to work. Like, it's when you feel the need to keep pouring into it and you're getting out of it, that's what it is. And like, as soon as like he said that, like, there was like a wave of anxiety just like washed away from me. And my shoulders felt lighter. And like, it was like the clouds parted and I could see light, 'cause that made sense. Like, I didn't feel like I had to, there weren't boxes I had to check. There weren't, you know, download counts I had to get to. There weren't all these requirements that I had to hit. It was just like, that makes sense. Like, this is just a perpetual thing, because I kind of reverse engineer that back into like, there's always going to be people. Like, industries are going to change, jobs are going to change, technology is going to change, but there's always going to be people. We're always going to need to connect. We're always going to need to talk. We're always going to be going through things. So having those conversations, having those connections is always going to be a way to get through it. And so kind of reversing back to the original question, a lot of that, it just went from there, as far as like, these are very powerful stories that will connect people outside of just this room too. And everybody here usually had, everybody in that room generally had a platform of being an artist, being in the mental health profession as far as a therapist or a counselor already, or they had started a blog and had, you know, 10,000 followers or something already. So they were already telling stories. This was just another avenue to tell their story in a different way.
So one of the things that's connected to that is, you know, when we're talking about these conversations on mental health, you brought up this really interesting thing where I was mentioned with stigma, how people can sort of make a hierarchy, and mentioned earlier in Matthew's interview how you're asked to measure out and do all these kind of things. But one of the coolest things about Anthologies of Hope is that it's not this sort of salacious attempt to talk about mental health. There's, you know, not, this isn't like trying to serve tea or anything, but there might be a tendency to think you have to have the most bombastic or the most heart-pulling, gut-wrenching story, except anyone's story, if it brought a challenge into the life, can be gut-wrenching and things like that. So even though it may not fit a visible mold in somebody's idea of a marketing thing, one of the coolest things is just how many different stories are so diverse, but they do come back to a lot of the same sort of issues. It's sort of an affirmation of this idea that we're in this together. And I kind of wanted to just sort of ask, from where you're producing it and you're sitting there on the side and you've been connected, what are some of the other episodes you've recorded where, just like with Joel, you found yourself sort of unaware that something was going to impact you and it just sort of hit?
Ideally, it's too many to count, because there's almost a, for folks that don't follow, we're on Instagram at Anthologies of Hope. And generally for each episode, I share one or two quotes. And in the beginning, I thought I was going to have to work to, you know, find pull quotes and things like that, or things that I could work with. But generally, most of the guests, just based on their stories and what they're telling, they're amazing. And they're just like hitting me over the head with these things where I'm like, okay, yep, that's another one. And like, they're things that I go by and just, and live by later on. And there's just so many different aspects of it where one of my favorite moments from the first season, I do them in about 10 to 12 episode seasons. One of my friends, she was talking about how she had lost contact with her counselor and she just hadn't heard from her, and literally her like counselor had ghosted her. And so she was like, okay, like, I'm busy in school. Like, I lost a couple of months, whatever. I'll reach back out. And then the counselor, or she called the counseling center, and they were like, oh, well, nobody told you. And they're like, what? And she's like, oh, Carol died. And it was like, okay, so like she, with retrospect, obviously that's not a way like they should literally handle her just being literally ghosted. But now it ends up being a conversation where when I'm talking to her, I'm like, what would Ghost Carol say? Like I went, like we're talking about it now where like she, the levity of that conversation that we had ended up being a case to bring her the ability to say, okay, like I have the tools because like I had those conversations with her and she's gone on to see additional counselors, but like she's had the tools and like, so it ended up being like a really wild ride, but now she's able to like turn that around and make it like laughable and use that as a something in her toolbox. And then there's just so many different conversations because I started out as bringing together all the people that I knew from Heart Camp, and there were different ways of kind of connecting. And like you were saying, it's definitely a wide spectrum of experiences. And so it's a weird thing when I'm producing them to go in and like when you upload them, you can tag them. So it's weird to kind of try to distill it down to get like a set number of tags. So there's always like a little bit of just like anxiety or consternation when I'm sitting there like, what all do I kind of pull out? Because like, I don't want to distill it down just to those things. But then it ends up being like, there's common conversations about depression, common conversations about anxiety. And so just having all of that, and then the understanding that once you start having the conversation and talking, then there's, you know, you see ways out of or dealing with your depression, see ways out of and dealing with your anxiety, or knows what, once you start talking about it more, you can understand what triggers you or triggers your anxiety to kind of avoid those situations. So there's definitely in all of those pieces, like there's, it's just as beneficial for me to hear those stories as it is to basically help produce them, because I'm taking little pieces of each and every story and kind of putting it in my mental tool belt to kind of keep going.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a theme of resiliency like fluid within all of the stories, or I guess what common themes do you see each story kind of portraying? Because you were saying it doesn't matter like how intense the story may be, but they kind of all possess the same theme. So I guess how does resiliency play a role?
The biggest thing I've seen in all the stories, looking at it in an aggregate, is there's a lot that is instilled in us in our youth. And for whatever reason, we think we carry that on with us for the rest of our life. And it's been something that I've been trying to understand what that is, but it's something where we were conditioned to not want to question that a lot. And so the metaphor that I've been thinking of is like, if you start reading a book and it's a bad book, you're not going to read it till the end just because you started it, or some people do, but I tried not to. I've done that multiple times, but as a whole, it wrecks the metaphor.
I quit reading it.
But yeah, so it's like if it's a bad book or if it's a bad story or bad movie, then like just stop it and go to something else. So it's like if we have these practices and we're conditioned to feel a certain way and we're conditioned to do something and we know it's not working for us, like what is preventing us from changing? Just because when we were 10, 11, 12, we were told one certain thing. So that's the biggest thing for me is hearing these stories is the kind of like the epiphany that people have in their early 20s, mid 20s to understand that like their mental health is on them. Like they're responsible for it. They have the ability to say yes, say no, set boundaries, and understand what that means. Whereas when for the majority of your life up to that point, you're generally surrounded by your family. And some people don't have constructive families. Some people don't have families that understand boundaries. Some people don't really have supportive families, all of that stuff. And again, it's meta coming back to the first Convo Cafe we recorded, which was all in the family. So it ends up being a case where you have to advocate for yourself. And so it ends up being once you start kind of peeling the layers of that onion to understand the what you have available to you, and then that you can be your own advocate, and that if you need something to change, it's not your fault if somebody else says or you offend somebody else because they couldn't do something, they couldn't do enough for you in your formative year. So it just ends up being like really being empowering and forcing yourself to be your own advocate.
Yeah, that's so I keep thinking like the ability to tell a story, I hope it encourages people to keep doing it. Because I think with resiliency, there's a lot of judgment of people like, why aren't they bouncing back from that little thing that happened to them? Like, oh, why can't they just do it? But I think the ability to tell a story allows people to understand that they are trying, they are going through that process, and that it's happening. And so kind of takes away that judgment for people to just be like, oh, they're not trying anything. They're not being resilient. It's like, no, they are. Listen to their story. Hear it.
And yeah. it goes a long way to see how people tell their story too, yeah. because there's some people that will tell their story in a very chronological way and they'll hit every bullet point along the way. And like, they know like what they're working through, what they've tried, what's worked, what's failed. And there's some people that just kind of jump all over the place. And I don't know if that's a left brain, right brain thing or how some of it's processing, but it is an interesting way to hear everything that somebody has saying, like, this is what I've been through and it's made me who I am today. And I want to share it because I think it could help somebody else. And so whether that's, you know, pure chronologically or more just like all over the place, it's they're always interesting conversations to kind of navigate.
You know, and I'm glad you bring that up as we sort of, you know, wind this one down a little bit is when we talk about stigma as the biggest obstacle to effective prevention of mental health care, and we talk about this idea of silence, how it's going to manifest itself, and I alluded to this a little earlier with the sort of mental health monolith and a sense of more important or less important. But with Anthologies of Hope, and what we hope with a thing like Conversations Cafe, is one of the, and I'm really just basing this especially or jumping off of when you were talking about how people are sort of coming to grips with this in their 20s, and hopefully we can have this earlier, is the fact that your story matters. Reaching out for help and support, when we talk about stigma and things like that, some of the biggest obstacles are feeling like you're not worthy of there being a better life. That, you know, especially for people who are experiencing things where you're not seeing the external visibility, and a lot of it manifests as a lot of sort of reoccurring and self-destructive thoughts. It's so critical for people to be able to understand their story matters. Being able to embrace that means that you can go through the work, whether it's a short-term or long-term thing, of turning that into a story that they enjoy thinking about and reading. So I think one of the, and this just doubles down on what I was saying before, with Anthologies of Hope and these opportunities to share stories from everyone, whether it's a high visibility person or someone that you know, and the idea that I can hear this and connect to it and things like that, one of the best bank shots out of that is this idea of thinking that your personal experience does not have to fit some sort of Hollywood narrative or anything like that. Your story matters only exclusively for you, for your self-worth. And you're worthy of love, and you're worthy of finding a fulfilling experience. So I think two things I'd like to do before you close out is sort of, again, this has been a running theme for the night, is just where is Anthologies of Hope going next? And then where can people find you in social media?
So doing that backwards, I mean, we're all over social media, but, I mean, Facebook and Instagram is just Anthologies of Hope, anthologiesofhope.com. The podcast is downloadable, findable on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and those are the only ones I use. But then we push them out to a bunch more, so they're all out there. So we're recording most of the season three now. By end of day tomorrow, we should have 5 of the 10 episodes or 5 of the 10 interviews recorded, and then we'll have actually we've got Johnny scheduled to come up, and then Mike, another member of the Convo Cafe team, coming up
is
soon
that
too.
Hope the day founder and CEO Johnny Boucher.
That would be it. Yes,
and Mike
Vinopal.
Mike Vinopal, education.
Okay. So yeah, so what there's going to be, and so at the time we planned it, it wasn't announced that Joel was the public policy director, but now it was announced then. So when it goes live, this will be a very heavy Hill for the Day season, so we can have a follow-up conversation if the rest of the panel here wants to do long-form interviews as well. But looking to just expand that out, one of the places I push myself to work at the most is writing. Again, my best form of expression is just conversation and just building things with my hands, but I don't consider myself that much of a writer. So we're going to be starting a blog portion of the website. And I've got a fun project. I'm stealing it from the artist name, but the Eureka Project, but using art as inspiration for writing blog posts. So former guests of the show, are going to be writing some blog posts inspired by one of my favorite artists, artists I've met through the convention scene, and we'll be that'll be launching around the same time. I have a friend who I met through Heart Camp that he is he just got his doctorate recently, and he's I don't want to say what it is because I don't know exactly what he got it in, but it's in the mental health field, and so we're going to be doing essentially mental health minute episodes or snippets, so that there's a lot of research happening that is valuable to everybody in this room and everybody listening, but it's published in such a way that it's never going to be found, or it's written in such a way that you're never going to understand it. So we're going to break some of that down and just make it so it's very simple reading, and just kind of get it out there in snackable bites, so that you can be like, oh, I've heard about that, but I never knew what it was, or I didn't know how applicable it was to me. So looking to do that, and then just the long form interviews as well as Convo Cafe type stuff. So looking to just expand that out into a couple of different avenues and a couple of different forms of content, and keep it going.
Cool. And if
I was just saying awesome.
Awesome. If somebody wanted to share their story on Anthologies of Hope, they just go.
Oh, just go to anthologiesofhope.com. We've got a contact us page there, and just submit that. And I mean, there's actually one of the interviews we've got scheduled for tomorrow is just specifically that, somebody who's been to other Convo Cafes here and then submitted, and she's a Chicago local, and we're just recording at the Hope offices tomorrow and getting that in there. Yeah, so you can just go and submit the contact us form, and then we'll be in touch.
Perfect. Rick Osowski, thank you so much for joining us. Anthologies of Hope.
Thank you.
Because now that it's in my head, I want to be like, Mike Wazowski. So we're coming into our last guest today, and we're hearing stories about people whose intersections with resiliency, you have this visual experience, you have this creative endeavor that raises the visibility there, and we're sharing stories through the power of audio. But I think it's not, again, that big of a revolutionary statement to say that one of the most powerful mediums for people being able to find strength and empowerment is through the written or visual word. And we had, I'm trying to think of the full like pathology for this, but a little while ago, a magical little book showed up in the Hope for the Day offices. And it was something that you kind of right on the face of it were like, okay, this seems like a book about mental health. And this is an absolutely 110% true story. Every single intern and paid staff member of Hope of the Day who would pick up the book and be like, oh, this is cute, and would open it within the first two pages, was like, whoa, that got heavy really quick. And it was so counterintuitive. But when we talk about this idea of resiliency, sometimes one of the most important things to do is figure out an effective way to start the conversation and communicate it and deliver it. And the book I'm talking about is this beautifully illustrated book called Gentle Mentals. And we are unbelievably thrilled and honored to have as our guest the creative author of Gentle Mentals, Veronica Padilla. Come on up. Fantastic. So, Veronica, thank you so much for joining us. This book is an absolute marvel. You know, you have the dedication in here that goes dedicated to all the gentle mentals out there. It takes one to love one. And as you're reading it and you go into the pages, it has a sort of poetic feel, right? And like one of the first ones has this, like, it sort of anthropomorphizes or sort of works along that idea, connecting mental health experiences. And so on one of the first pages, you have this anxiety alley, and it's a picture of like an alligator. And here's the poem. It goes, anxiety alley, can't catch any sleep. And then it's a quotation from Alley. At this point, I just want to murder these sheep. So it takes on this tone, but it starts to just sort of showcase beautifully, you know, small bits and small bites of these concepts of diagnosable mental illnesses. So I just, you know, absolutely gorgeous illustrations and everything. Just sort of let's start as we've been doing tonight. How did you even get to, what's the story to get to Gentle Mentals?
Okay. So I am also a suicide survivor, and I'm also the daughter of a suicide survivor. And so I'll start there. One of my earliest childhood memories was waking up to sirens and lights, and I went to go see what it was, and it was my dad, and he was in the kitchen with the big kitchen knife and his fist balled up, and he was sobbing, and he saw me, and he said, I'm so sorry for what I'm about to do, but I can't bear the pain. And so it didn't happen. He actually, the police came in time. They saved it. But it was just the beginning of a lot of things that happened in my life. And so, unfortunately, sorry, this is hard.
It's okay.
He suffered with a lot of mental illness. And Anxiety Alley, that was him. He couldn't sleep. And, you know, he was constantly on edge because, as humans, we need sleep. It's so important. So that was one thing. He tried to will himself to death by way of anorexia and bulimia. He just refused to eat, and when he did eat, he would vomit it up. And I witnessed it firsthand. I'd find the drippings. I saw him throwing it into a napkin. So that was another thing. I'm looking at the characters as I reference like everything. Morbidly depressed, what else? A bit of a hypochondriac. He swore something was wrong, but they couldn't figure it out. He was on tons of medication, and we didn't know what it was for. So needless to say, it was rough growing up. And then I became a teen, which is really rough on its own. So you couple those things together. And then I met a boy. And so all of that put together was just the perfect storm for disaster. So this was not a good guy. He was kind of a bad guy, and he got in trouble with the law, and he got sent back to where he came from, which was LaGrange, Georgia. And so I decided it was a good idea when I was 15 years old to run away from home and to go pack up all my stuff and meet him and live with him, just basically run away, start a new life, and escape the life that I had. And so I did that. When I got there, it obviously was not a good thing. And he basically was seeing somebody else. And it destroyed me because he was like the one thing that I had left in my mind at the time. Like I my world was very small. And so I decided, well, that was it, because I was taught that, you know, when pain is unbearable, you just pull the plug. Like, that's what I learned. And so I took a Costco bottle of painkillers and chased it with a 40 of Mickey's. And I cried myself to sleep, and I thought, okay, that's it. I'm going to do it, because no one's supposed to come home, and that's pretty much it. And it turns out that somebody actually got off work early for whatever reason. They found me. They called the ambulance. And so I woke up in the ambulance. They're like, you know, trying to keep me alive. Got my stomach pumped. And when the dust settled, the nurse came in, and she said, sweetie, you are a miracle, because you flatlined and you should be dead. So you are meant to be here. So that stayed with me, and, you know, I bounced back, but it wasn't like that was a life-changing moment. I just kind of carried on. And so finally, you just keep chugging. Through that, I found the creative world, and that you could actually get a job in making art. And I thought, wow, I found my people. So I dug deep into graphic design and art direction and, you know, product design, anything that was in the design umbrella. And I kind of poured myself into that. And I didn't actually realize that it was a coping mechanism until pretty recent. I kind of just did it because I could just lose myself, and kind of the world would kind of drop off, and I could just make stuff. And so it wasn't until like maybe 2015 that I had the idea for the book. And so I started to write it, and it was all pure accident. My stepdaughters basically said something that sounded like bipolar bear, and I thought it was funny. And it made me smile, and so I thought, oh, my God, I can do so many characters. That's what I'm going to make a book about. And so I started writing it, and it's kind of like in Dr. Seuss tone where everything rhymes, all the characters. And I know every single one of these characters, either through myself and my own stuff or through my dad or, you know, just pretty much, I mean, everybody deals with something. And so when I started to share the characters, most people can resonate or see themselves in one of them or a family member or somebody that they know. So that's kind of the long-winded version of and the backstory of why this came to be. And I feel like beyond... you know, illustration and design, I also found a lot of comfort in humor. And humor, for me, is also another coping mechanism. I love to find it wherever I can. And if I'm having a bad day, I put on stand-up comedy. I seek it out because I will pay money, make me laugh right now. So that's kind of my approach.
Yeah, I mean, you know, number one, glad you're still here. Thank you for sharing your story on that part. And two, I got to ask, pulling from your personal experiences or creating this book, what was that like? Was this something where it sort of all floodgated out at once, or was it kind of an arduous journey where, you know, maybe there was one animal and then you had to step back for a second and then... How did that look
as soon
for you?
As Bipolar Bear came out, I feel like they were all there. So I had the names immediately. And then I wrote the story on my commutes when I was living in New York. So I used to take the ferry in and out, and I would spend my commute time writing. And then it fell in the back burner for a while because you just get busy and you just don't find the time to finish these personal projects. And it wasn't until... I was diagnosed with MS that I had the fire lit to do something and not waste that miracle that she said. I was, because I, you know, I didn't know if I'd get out of it. And I thought, I can't waste this life and not do something.
You know, that's, and you dropped that hammer in there.
I know. I didn't want to take it so far off, but there's another story of resilience in there too.
So I want to, and we'll come back to that in a half second, but one of the things that, so with or without this book, when you're talking about graphic arts and from your lived experience, because you didn't drop your resume, okay, you have been a very highly accomplished person in the graphic arts world, right, and in marketing, and I think that because... when people talk about mental health, there's correlations with deficiency, unreliability, incompetency, and things like that. And I just want to sort of, you're there on your talents, right? You have gotten these amazing opportunities on your talents, but did it ever sort of, that your lived experience, was that something you'd never tell anyone? You know, how did that, as you navigated into sort of,
did anyone know that story?
Yeah, like your lived experience, like before.
Nobody knew. Like I came out of the closet when this book came out, and it felt so. I cried for 2-3 hours when I hit the send button to like post my Facebook story and all that stuff. And I cried many times writing the story behind it, even just like on the website. And so that was really different, but it was also really interesting because as soon as I put it out there, so many people had their own story, and I thought that was so cool. And they were like, oh my God, I've known you my whole life, and I had no idea that this happened. Like, how? They just couldn't compute, and then they'd tell me their story about their parent or their issues or whatever it was. And I was like, oh wow, that's amazing.
So, I mean, that kind of leads into that question of, I mean, there was, did you feel like you wanted other people to know, you know, to make that connection? Because the way the poems is kind of, not just your personal life, but like, you know, a lot of the poems are very excellent ways you could start a conversation with someone. If you had an 8-year-old or a 75-year-old read this, that, I mean, the conciseness is so sharp that someone can readily identify, you know, and you read the bipolar section. So I'm just, was that kind of the intention, like, to simplify a conversation, or was it, you know?
I honestly wrote about how I experienced it or through the relationship, so it just was, but yes, I did want to keep it very simple and digestible and easy and approachable, and it was just so familiar. I feel like that's where it all kind of came together, so it, and I did some research too, I was trying not to offend people, because it's just such a touchy topic, and humor is something that they don't, most places, like mental illness and humor just doesn't go together, typically, and so it's, I was trying to be very careful to not cross lines, because I'm not making fun of it, but I am bringing humor into it, and I feel like that's a fine line.
Did you, I think I'm going to ask, have you had responses where people were like, what are you making
fun? I haven't, okay. But NAMI, you know, I've been approached and have approached a lot of like the big places like NAMI and American Mental Health and those sort of places, and they see it and they love it initially, the first like lines of defense, they're like, yes, let's work together, and then as it goes up the chain of commands, it gets squashed.
Right.
And so
yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny, because I'm wondering if that's how we ended up with the book. It's like somebody at one of the others was like, hey, why don't you have this?
Oh, really?
But that's really important, because when we're talking about this idea of resiliency and the way this book is a representation of your own resiliency that you've survived through, pressed out and found a way, and sharing your lived experience, obviously, wasn't the bed of roses. It all got fixed in a simple snap. But because, you know, you brought it up, and I wasn't sure whether to talk about it, but there's also now case study in, you've now confronted a MS diagnosis, and here you are still wanting to go out and function and things, and it's not fall apart and like this, and then I'm going to just pack it up and fall away. So I just, aside from just being unbelievably impressed and you know, amazed, you know, with resilience, sort of talk about like how that process went through, and what did you turn to sort of be like, all right, here we go.
Yeah. So I feel like life is just a series of ups and downs, and I feel like the more you get knocked down and get back up, you just get better at it. And so I kind of feel like I was thinking about this when the topic was about resiliency, and I thought about like the phases and the levels of resiliency, and I feel like my level one was that I didn't have any at first, but then I went through it, and then the next level was like you just kind of go through it, and then the next level is you go through it and you learn something and you get something out of whatever that negative thing was, and then this next phase that I'm in right now is you get knocked down, you get back up, you learn something, and then you try to help other people with it. And I thought, that's kind of where I'm at in this phase. And so with the MS diagnosis, it forced me to try to find something good that I could then help others with. And so beyond the book, I'm now a functional medicine health coach. And so the whole basis of that is really promoting self-care, and it's, you know, sleep, it's diet, it's exercise, it's stress management and all that stuff. So I've been able to tie that together to Gentle Mentals because it's so important to take care of ourselves. And I think someone said it earlier, like a healthy mind lives in a healthy body, and it's not separate. So you have to it should be just like mandatory to kind of take care of yourself when you're dealing with mental health or any health issues. So that's how I'm managing the MS, is diet, lifestyle, environmental, all the things.
And why I bring that up is because there's such a thing as dual diagnosis, right? People can have sometimes an untold story in mental health is when it's a physiological thing or a neurological thing that it wasn't connected, and that can then lead to other challenges. So where we go with that and you sort of taking what is ultimately maybe a negative and then turning it into this positive, that's part of what Jackie was talking about in the start, this bounce back thing. And I wanted to sort of touch on this idea because I cannot ignore that pillow, that gorgeous pillow. The book's been published and you continue to work through, and what is it? There's more of the projects, right? Because I saw some of the things developing. So I just wanted to talk about that. I was wondering, because not just as a side note, if the pillow's for sale, because
I love that pillow.
But as you've gone both with the life coaching, sort of like what further have you done with Gentle Mentals at this point, right?
Yeah. So the book, when I started making it, I'm like, well, this is bigger than a book. And so I created the website, and the website has resources and sort of definitions of a lot of the mental illnesses that are portrayed. And then I developed some products and prints and journals, and I'm still kind of growing the product line. This is a pillow. This is depressed dolphin. And then the back says, "This too shall pass." And so kind of being able to ride the wave. So really just trying to create some positive messaging and also products that kind of support you when you're having a tough time. Also did an animated short version of the book. And that one has gotten some traction, where it's been into 18 film festivals around the world, which is really cool. And I got to go to Geneva last year to the United Nations and accept an award, which was really kind of mind-blowing. I didn't sleep all night. I was so nervous, more nervous than I am now. but yeah, I'm just trying to grow the project. I'm still open. I'm trying to figure out what it is and how it connects. I've got a Instagram page, and I'm doing new original art on that page that promotes self-care a bit more. Doing another talk in September. Hopefully I won't cry at that one.
I think you did great. Well, one thing that I definitely appreciate about this is, being a therapist, it's easy for people to open up because I'm kind of like with them for, the length of the session. So I can kind of pull, but it really offers kind of like, how when I wear my Hope for the Day bracelet, it offers like a conversation where people can go, "Oh, I know what that is." This book, I think, is really powerful with just even like putting it on a coffee table or setting it out. People will start talking and they can kind of use it as like a tool to start talking, which is really cool. I really appreciate that.
And so, Veronica, a lot of what you've, I love how you've talked about this sort of you're learning to, resilience is this process of learning and going through it. So as you have went through that learning, now that you've published the book and you're into this now phase of your life, I'd really love to know sort of what are some newer things that you've learned about yourself or learned about sort of just mental health in general and just sort of life experience at this point.
New things about myself. Gosh, every day there's something new, but I think that's a good question. I'm not sure. I feel like I'm learning more about other people through this process, and I think that's really interesting, and just being able to connect with so many people. And especially Instagram, I think, is so powerful because people connect with you directly. And, schizophrenia is one of the characters in their schizo. that's one that I actually did not have a lot of experience with. And someone who had schizophrenia reached out to me and said, "Thank you." And they said, I it's the first time anyone put us on the same level as everyone else because they're afraid of us. And I really appreciate it. And I thought that blew my mind, where I was like, that's so cool. Oh my gosh. Cause I was so afraid of offending, cause it's not one that I had personal experience with. But I wanted to be inclusive and actually touch on it. And so I'm I was glad I did.
You know, and that's such a good way to sort of put into this, you know, is the fact that the book doesn't have a sort of hierarchical approach, saying it's one's more important than the other. It's a totally unintentional feature of the institutional level of mental health, where, again, we're going back to this idea of stigma and a monolith and a hierarchy, and sometimes unintentionally even clinicians will talk about mental health in terms of like a more important and less important. And hope for the day, we want to sort of knock down that thing, and it's a spectrum. There's more visible and less visible. So when you're, because obviously there's the lived experience part, but then you're also talking about things that you had to go and research. People's responses, because the book is so powerful, and I feel like the life of is just beginning, because you're, how you keep talking about sort of like not wanting to offend anyone, or, you know, as be mindful of that, rather. Being able to press this conversation, there has been, and I'm, this is me just sort of stepping out of the soapbox for a second, there's been too much hesitation and not enough lived experience representation in this conversation. We've had a lot of people who are telling us what's best for us or what we're going through. So I feel like this is a start of a thing, even though it's been, you know, it's copyrighted 2016, right? So as you're progressing forward, are you seeing the same reactions or different reactions every time someone engages this for the first time? Like,
It's interesting. I see people being receptive and open to it, and I've made a lot of therapist friends lately, and they also are like, wow, this is great. I put it on my coffee table at work, and you know, people pick it up and they've taken pictures of the post-it notes that they get, and they've been positive, and so that's really affirming. What other kind of reactions have I gotten? Pretty positive. I get it. It's a breath of fresh air, and I thought that was a really cool comment, because mental illness is heavy. It gets really dark, and I kind of, that was the whole reason I took this approach, because it's dark enough. Let's normalize it and make it very just conversational. Let's just open it up in a different way. I think there's something there. I hope there is.
Well, no, and that's, there absolutely is. I mean, I can't understate it enough or overstate it enough. This, both the initial book and your continued work and ways to enhance it and put it together, it's absolutely phenomenal. It's a breathtaking piece of an approach. One of the reasons we wanted to connect with you, so, you know, when I saw this, it was actually our education lead, Mike Van Opel, who introduced the book to me. And I saw it for like 2 seconds, and I'm like, it was, I don't know, it was kind of like a 1940s movie. I was like, Fermi Veronica, sure as you can. Like, I wanted to connect with you because, so we took an approach at Hope of the Day with like the black and white and sort of moved away from some of like the official suicide colors, because we wanted to, our stance was, we're going to just have the no BS like conversation. As colorful and as immaculately designed as this is, and the other ensuing work around it, it's actually, I saw it as the same philosophical concept, that it's putting an approach to mental health that is bold and not afraid to have this conversation. The humorous and all of that, that's actually just as critical to it. I mean, just as essential as the fact that it's not, oh, let's laugh and lighten the load. It's, we ought to be able to talk about this with all the emotions. This does not have to be exclusively a somber thing. Etc. So, before we sort of wrap up for the night, I just wanted to sort of double, quadruple, and triple down, and just acknowledge just how radically phenomenal your creation is. It is tremendous. And you know, we over the day want to like figure out every sort of way that we can just amplify and shout out to the platforms and the rooftops. I, you know, before we sort of go into like, where can people find your work and things like that, love to just hear some words on like where your headspace is right this moment and sort of what you're looking forward to down the road.
Well, I have a few dreams. I really would love to make plushies. It sounds silly, but I think there's something really cool to have something external that you can hold that is holding space for the thing that you're dealing with. A lot like this pillow, and that you could just, I don't know, I think there's something there.
It's exerting the energy.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's one thing. And then something, I don't know if this is silly or genius, but I want to do sort of a Vagina Monologues meets Sesame Street meets comedy, some sort of theatrical like expression of Gentlemanals where you've got these characters introducing, like saying their lines, and then it brings on like a new sort of improv style comic talking about the mental illness. And just, I just think it would be really interesting.
I think
to
it's
see
genius.
It. I think it'd be entertaining. It'd be thought provoking. It'd be cool to look at, fun to watch, and inclusive. So I just, like, that's my dream.
You know, I know someone who's involved in theatrical work like that. Not, you know, that's an original idea. But remind me to hook you up with a homie named Kate Smith. Before we have you make your final drops, I want to let folks, the audience, know here, we've been blessed. We tried to secure, like, a little shipment of books. So I'm not putting you on the spot this time, don't worry. But we do, if you are interested in grabbing in Gentlemanals books, we went in and purchased a grip of them. For you all to have as audience members. So you get a book and you get a book. But Veronica, where can people follow up on Gentlemanals and secure other materials and works from you?
Yeah, so gentlemanals.com. And then the handle for Instagram is at Gentlemanals. I suggest going through the website because if you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble's, I don't know. Because it's through a distributor, so it's better if it comes through the website. So gentlemanals.com. There's prints, there's journals, there's t-shirts. And a portion of the proceeds goes to American Society for Mental Health. I'm forgetting the name already.
Is it AFSP?
Yes.
American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Thank you.
One of our sponsors.
Yes, so a portion goes there. So it's kind of a full circle of.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for being our final guest on this episode, Veronica. You're an absolute treasure. Your work is phenomenal. Thank you so much. Everyone, Veronica Padilla. So as we're winding out this episode, I want everyone to sort of just pay attention, listening here at home, to this idea that when we're talking about this idea of resiliency, how you find it is its own exploration. It's not just reading a self-help book and you're going to get it. It can take trial and error. And when we talk about resiliency, what that means is it doesn't look like just one thing. It looks differently, it feels differently, and it's secured differently in a lot of different ways. And before I start putting my last closing notes, I wanted Jackie to just get your thoughts on our guest real quick.
Veronica?
No, just everyone.
Our guest. I just love all of the different outlets that everyone chooses to use personally, and it kind of all comes back to the same theme of what worked for them and not kind of forcing it to work for anyone else, but kind of sparking an idea of, oh my gosh, so many different things could work for me. So, I mean, just looking at this book, I mean, being an artist myself, like there's so many outlets within just the art community of drawing, painting, graphic design. And so it doesn't have to be, you know, let me try exactly what worked for that person and see if it works for me. It's really finding whatever it is that inspires you and makes you feel good, I think, at the end of the day. It makes you just want to play and have fun. That can be your tool for resiliency and allow you to be able to bounce back. And if you don't bounce back on the first one, try another one. Try more than one. Try many at the same time. So I think that's kind of what I took away the most from listening to everybody's different stories and what works for them.
Perfect. And to close out tonight, the takeaway I want everyone to just focus on is that when we talk about the idea of resiliency, I want you to understand it beyond the buzzword and beyond a hashtag and understand that having resiliency and how you want to take this to heart is that it represents the real truth about our mental health. We are not perfectly, flawlessly sculpted human beings, and that's not our legacy and future. Your mental health is ever shifting. Your wellness is ever shifting. Having cracks or fissures can be healed up again, and that's what being able to embrace resiliency is about, is that it's embracing the imperfectness. It's embracing that there are, as Veronica mentioned, ups and downs and these ebbs and flows. And resiliency is both a series of tools, but also it's a series of psychological reminders around what we had hoped for the day sort of drive home on, this idea that it's okay not to be okay. And if you can take that to heart, especially as we close out tonight, that becomes the core of building your resiliency. That if you can remember, it's okay not to be okay. When you rent low, you don't have to think of it as this is the final straw. There are options out there. There is hope. And you do deserve to find a fulfilling sense of life. So with that, I want to thank everyone both here at Sip of Hope Live and listening wherever for joining us on this Conversations Cafe. I hope you all have a great night. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.